Hello, I'm Michael.
Hello, I'm Linda. And we're here to, I think, perhaps our final episode in this Grand Tour series. We're very pleased, very excited to be in the city of Rome with our Grand Turisti, Milordis. And we just wanted to kind of consider the city of Rome itself has been at the center stage of civilization since antiquity. It was always perceived as this Caput Mundi, the capital of the world during the antique period. That image endured, that myth was perpetuated by the city, and over the course of time, through history and literature and through indeed the imagery of the city of Rome, there was that physical evidence and the presence of the extraordinary achievements of Roman art and architecture has endured. And that manner of dissemination was something that we've always thought we've kind of been conveying through the eyes of our grand tourists as they arrived in Rome, and the contrast alternating between the ancient and the modern city, but also right throughout Italy, we find that balance between the ancient and the modern. And it has helped us, hopefully, you've enjoyed appraising this enduring influence and the grand, the presence that is the medieval, the Renaissance, Baroque and modern periods through art and architecture, and Italy being at its core. And indeed, one whole area that perhaps we, you know, the impact of Christianizing of Rome is something that's really at center of the city, the center of the pilgrimage routes, the center we've often referred to the Holy Roman Empire. That, and you mentioned, Michael, just recently that Charlemagne was crowned in the third mass, I think it is, on Christmas Day in St. Peter's. So papal patronage has always been important. And the building, the construction of the greatest of the buildings in Christendom, St. Peter's, San Pietro, begins during the time of Constantine, and over time it's changed, and it's the image of that has endured, an important theme throughout this. So let's have a look today at some of its iconography. Let's have a look at some of the presence and how, you know, St. Peter's is at the heart of the city of Rome.
Well, according to tradition, St. Peter came to Rome, possibly being brought as a prisoner. Maybe that's a possibility, or he may have decided to move to Rome, but there's actually no literary foundation for his time in Rome whatsoever. With Paul, there is information, because in the Acts of the Apostles, we find Paul is brought to Rome because he's facing a charge of sedition. So we do have something about Paul. We don't have any information about his death in the Acts of the Apostles, which is a scriptural foundation, a foundational document. But according to tradition, both Peter and Paul, who knew each other, they lived in Rome for a short period, and they both died there as martyrs to the Christian faith. And according to tradition, Peter was brought out to the Circus of Nero, the Circus of Nero and Caligula, which is outside Rome. It was across the boundary of the Tiber River, close to the mausoleum of the Emperor Adrian. And according to the tradition, after the Great Fire of Rome, which took place in July of 64, a group of followers of Christ, of Crestus, as it was called, were brought over to the area of the Vatican Hill at the Circus of Caligula and Nero. And the Emperor Nero, according to the historian Tacitus, dressed the Christians in animal skins. He dipped them in tar, strapped their bodies to wooden pillars, and set them alight to provide illumination for the nighttime games. So it was a pretty grisly time. Roman forms of execution, either by crucifixion for criminals or by beheading for citizens, was a bloody way of dispatching people, and life was very cheap in the ancient world. Maybe we could say that is still the same today, but nevertheless, that's where the origins of the cult of Peter begins. Now, as far as we know, as I say, there aren't any literary foundations, or there's no text that we can refer back to, but we have a lot of archaeological texts, and based on these we know of a presbyter, a priest called Gaius, who around 180 AD wrote that if you want to go and see the trophies or the memorials of Peter, you go to the Vatican Hill. If you want to see the trophy or memorial of Paul, you go to the Via Ostiense, the road to Ostia, and that's where both of them were executed and were buried. So that'll bring you to an interest, that'll bring you to the point where we've got this cult developing.
If I could just interject that idea of St. Paul, San Paolo fuori il muro. So he, that situation is outside the walls. That great church was on the road to Ostia. And Ostia, of course, is the ostium of the River Tiber, which was where originally the first sort of military fortified camp is, to protect the mouth of the river, the navigation route from there, the grain stores the city will develop. And it was always this very, very important connection between Ostia as the kind of grain store for Rome. It grows up as its own city, it develops, but it was, you know, the most busiest routeway from Ostia into Rome, and every Christian would pass St. Paul's, and very much part of the routeway into the city, but also part of the seven churches of Rome that pilgrims would attend to as they arrived in the city.
That's right, and I mentioned that the Emperor Nero led off this great persecution of the Christians, but after his death by suicide, the war, if you like, on Christians, that would be too strong a word, but the persecution of the Christians came to an end briefly. But from time to time over the next 2.5 centuries, we find sporadic persecutions against the Christians. But they weren't alone. There was only probably a very small number of thousands of Christians throughout the Roman Empire who were killed for their belief, which in terms of persecution isn't a huge number, and lots of other people were killed in battles and wars and other forms of conflict at the time. But the next important date we find is 312. The Emperor Constantine comes over to Rome. He wants to do battle with the Emperor Maxentius, who's the co-emperor. He wants to take single charge of the empire. And so there's the Battle of Milvian Bridge. It was a battle outside Rome. And during that battle, the Emperor Maxentius was killed by Constantine's troops. His muddied body was dragged downstream, and that was the end of him. Constantine entered the city and became the single ruler of the Roman experience at that time. Now, curiously, Constantine wasn't a Christian, but he believed in the Christian faith through his mother, Helen. And he decided to rescind or to confirm the Edict of Milan issued by Licinius, who had terminated the persecution of the Christians. And then Constantine showed his approval of the Christian faith by building, as you say, Linda, a number of churches, seven churches in all. Curiously, St. Paul's didn't figure among his churches. These were called memorial churches. They were built over the tombs of various martyrs, St. Lawrence, St. Agnes, and so forth. But the most important, of course, was the one which was built on the Vatican Hill, St. Peter's. And curiously, Constantine had the power as emperor to do something that nobody else could do. He was able to close down the necropolis in which Peter, according to tradition, had been buried. He was able to cut into the hill in order to make the centre of his memorial shrine, which we call a basilica or a church. He was able to cut into that so that the little area of the tomb, the putative tomb of Peter, would be based at that very point.
And also, isn't it so that his mother, Helena, she was a pilgrim coming back from Jerusalem with a piece of the true cross. She founded Santa Croce. So I think, as you say, some of these great basilican foundations were the memorial churches. But that basilican plan is what's relevant in terms of, you know, looking to the, I suppose, pagan building types in the Roman Forum. The basilica was the kind of very simple a covered assembly building, if you like, and it's something to cater for so many more people. So this building type is what's used for these large foundational churches.
Well, that's very important because, you see, prior to that, the Christians weren't allowed to worship in public, and they all lived in their homes, and they just invited their friends over to an apartment for Mass, etc., whatever their celebrations were. They were buried in the catacombs, so there was very little public building that we're aware of. So this one was the first building, which was really enormous. And as you say, they chose the basilica plan, which was the area of the, which was the style of the law courts in the ancient world. Came from the Greek basileus, the word for king. So that was where the king administered justice. And then the emperor, as the successor of the king, would administer his justice. So Constantine probably built this. His soldiers really did this because they'd finished the war and now they had to be put to work. And one of the reasons I would say, and in fact Lanciani, one of the great 19th century archaeologists, speculates on this as well, one of the reasons that Constantine was building so much was he needed to put his soldiers to work, because otherwise they'd get restless, they wouldn't be paid, they'd have no battles to work on.
Yes, and the other, during this this sort of first great phase of building for, I suppose, showcasing this new Christian, this tolerated religion, was he will give back what was the former knights, the cavalry fort, if you like, and it is over which is built San Giovanni in Laterano. So that's the cathedra, isn't that right?
Becomes the cathedral of Rome, and that was built on the lands of his wife Fausta, and this belonged to her family, and also the area, as you say, of the Praetorian Guards. So these two properties were contingent, and that's where he built his cathedral.
Interesting is Constantine, because at the same time as he has one foot and his eye on Rome, he's also another foot building, and the new Nova Roma, I should say, is at Constantinople. And he, in fact, also enacts a similar building campaign at the centre of that new city. So two very large basilican churches, the Saint Sophia of Wisdom and Saint Irene. So peace and wisdom and these notions of developing the liturgy will occupy the Christian clergies for here on, for variously a number of years going into the future.
Yes, that's very important because, as you say, Constantinople was his new city, the city of Constantine. That's now, of course, modern-day Istanbul in Turkey, and that is a very different area. He'd moved over to guard the eastern frontier. But St. Peter's is important as well, I think, for history, because it's erected probably within 10 years, between 6 and 10 years, and it stands until 1506. Already in the 1450s, Pope Nicholas V had decided that it was an unsafe building. It had shown cracks through various earthquakes that had happened over the years. It was also out of style, out of sync with the Renaissance coming along, when they were referring back to the glories of ancient Rome. Now this building looked pretty shabby. But Nicholas, who's a great early humanist pope and a great bibliophile, he wasn't able to do much more than start a plan, which he gave to Alberti to work out the basis of a new St. Peter's. But it didn't get going until Julius II in 1506 decided to demolish the whole building and to knock it down. And on Easter Sunday in April of 1506, he laid the foundation stone. And then, curiously, the basilica, which is quite large, had to be pulled down, but also rebuilt at the same time.
And is that this was the result of work by Bramante? And Bramante, we know one of his major legacies in Rome is the Tempietto, which joins the Spanish church of Filippo Neri. It is one of these Renaissance buildings that is completely circular. It's a small temple. It's sort of perfectly formed in terms of classical proportions. So it's a kind of miniature centralized structure, and it's something very like that Bramante would bring the centralized planning, a rotunda, to St. Peter's. And I think this was commemorated in that coin that was struck in 1506 for the beginnings of this building. But Bramante, his legacy, it is his legacy because he dies. And this has to be a project that continues with a series of extraordinary, notable architects of the time.
That's right, because Bramante was only a few years into the job when he died, and then they had to replace him. So afterwards we have Raphael, and then you have a list of all the great names of history. You're quite right. You have Michelangelo, you have Bernini, you have Maderno, Fontana, all these great names of the period. And the interesting thing is, because the popes are destroying ancient Rome and they're building up this new building, the new one took 120 years to put together. So it wasn't consecrated until 1626. So it was a long, long time being put together. And that's why it moved from a Renaissance building, as you quite rightly say, with the cupola at the centre. And Michelangelo, when he was an elderly man, the last work he actually was employed on, although he didn't take any fee for this, was the construction of the dome. And he died in 1564 before the dome had been completed, and they had to wait another 30 years until the pontificate of Sixtus V, and Fontana concluded the great dome and later on put on the wonderful lantern. So the building that we go to see in the modern Rome is very much a building which was 120 years in the making, lots of cooks in the pie, if you like. And what we end up with is something which is fantastically unified. And despite the fact that it took so many people who were tearing up each other's plans every year as they inherited the project, it still is one of the great iconic facades of the world.
Yes, and not to mention the erection of the obelisk in the centre, and the kind of final point, if you like, or finishing point for the earlier project of Sixtus V, of linking these great seven churches via, you know, a kind of a mapping out a route for the pilgrim through the city and ending up at this great, the centre of, you know, to look up at the great facade of the building, and then to have it wrapped, as you mentioned, by Bernini in this extraordinary armature. And Bernini will draw upon, you know, these wonderful antique ideas. As we mentioned earlier, the portico of the Pantheon is reflected here, because you really walk through a forest of columns to come into this extraordinary, you know, the great piazza that we know today of San Pietro.
That's right. And actually, you remind me, when you talk about the obelisk, of the great story of Sixtus V, that when the obelisk was being taken from the side of the new St. Peter's as it was being built, it had originally stood in the circus of Caligula and Nero. And you're quite right when you say that Sixtus wanted to have all the roads of Rome linking in a star shape, so you could look from one road down maybe a mile or two and see another obelisk. So these were the old Egyptian obelisks, which had been brought to Rome in imperial times and classical times, and then they were re-erected by Sixtus. And according to the story, on the day when the great obelisk was to be put into place, a huge wooden platform had been put together, mules and horses had been drafted in, and the sailors of Minisum had been called to oversee the erection of the obelisk, pulling it from the horizontal up into vertical space. And Sixtus has said, if anybody as much as breathes or says anything, they're going to be excommunicated. So all the crowd had gathered to watch this great event. It had never happened before in their lifetime. And one of the sailors shouted, "Water the ropes," because the ropes were beginning to fray. So they threw water on the ropes, and that prevented the ropes from cracking and the obelisk breaking. And the Pope, although he didn't excommunicate the man as he'd promised, he then gave him a very good reward, and he told him that his family, in perpetuity, could sell palm in the square on Palm Sunday for the rest of eternity. And I believe that family is still there, but I don't know if they sell Palm. They've probably moved into something else, maybe like hot dogs.
I hope they still sell Palm. That's a wonderful idea. And thinking of St. Peter's, so also, and I suppose another, always trying to kind of connect and link things. The last time we made reference to the Pantheon, which is over the other side of the river, of course, the bronze rosettes, which seem to have been melted down, Bernini would turn them into the extraordinary baldacchino, which sits over the centre altar within the grand kind of crescendo when you arrive into St. Peter's and head through the portico, through this extraordinary, very kind of marble encrusted interior. And what your eyes are drawn to is, of course, the baldacchino. And then behind it, through that, is that wonderful, the image of, the figure of the hand of God and the Holy Spirit arriving, this.
And the Holy Spirit itself is actually made from alabaster marble. It's not from glass. So most people were looking up and saying, wow, this is a wonderful thing. And the idea of the chair is like in a university, the cathedra, the chair of authority, whoever holds that is the senior lecturer, the senior person. And the chair then signifies the teaching authority of Peter and is supported by four bishops, two from the Greek church, two from the Latin church. And these are supporting the chair. So the whole concept is that the teaching authority of the Pope comes from God, illumined by the Holy Spirit, but all of this must be in union with the bishops of the church and with the whole church. So the Pope can't just decide to do something off his own bat, if you like. It's not permissible.
And with that, I suppose, linking into our 18th century views, the lasting impression of the city, that this artistic movement which grows out of the travel of the Grand Tour, the making of these souvenirs, isn't it? So Piranesi, Giovanni Battista Piranesi, will make one of the most enduring images that we know, the view through, it's slightly tilted, so it's a view through the great armature of Bernini to right past the obelisk to the great facade of St. Peter's. And it's something, it is a lasting impression that stays with us because that variously was copied. It was an engraving copied over time and brought by these 18th and 19th century travellers back to their homelands, perpetuating this great myth of Rome. And, while Rome has acted and the city acted as a backdrop for all these historical events that we've made reference to here and there, and this, but essentially the thinking, the enduring influence in both myth and reality, was what was brought back in terms of our Grand Tour. So our Grand Touristi would venture back. Some would go south, Naples, maybe to Sicily, the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, but always coming back to Rome and then heading back across the Alps, that arduous journey via Paris, back to London, back to Dublin, and heading out west to bring and build these impressions to their own country, to their own houses, the country houses, if you like, and the cities adjusted also therein.
But I think it's also true to say that everywhere that the tourists went back to, once they'd seen Rome, they brought back their architecture. And if you go to Madrid, Paris, London, Birmingham, Liverpool, wherever you want to go, so many of the buildings, even our own Dublin, so many of the buildings are visual echoes of the great past, which was Rome.
That's right. And with that in mind, I think we're considering, we must consider this impact and how this effect was felt. So waiting on that in installments for our next and forthcoming journeys that we're hoping to make.
Yes, because we've come to the end of the Grand Tour. We've accompanied the great tourists over 12, 13 episodes from day one when they left England, which was the great place of departure for the Grand Tour. But over our next number of podcasts, we're going to introduce you to a number of hidden gems. And these are places across the world which have great artistic merit. Some are very well known, some are almost unknown. So thank you very much for joining us on the tour, the Grand Tour, which was made in the 18th century by these wonderful, intrepid entrepreneurs, young aristocrats who wanted to spend a few months, even a few years, crossing the Alps, going to see the great fountains of civilization from the past and bringing that into the future. Now, as we've wrapped up our grand tour visit over the last 13 episodes, we'd like to thank you very much on my behalf and Linda's behalf. We'd like to thank you very much for keeping us company, and we hope you've enjoyed our visit. Our next series is going to be Hidden Gems, when we will bring you and introduce you to places of great merit, of artistic interest, and I hope you'll be happy to join us on our next great tour.
Yeah, and often erstwhile unsung heroes within that. So, you know, while we have these wonderful works of art, we'll also consider, you know, their environment and maybe who was involved and who we may know or who we do not know. So, yes, an exciting new adventure awaits.
Until the next time.